Good morning, and welcome to this second plenary session for the 16th Conference. I'm delighted to be here with Dr. Jean-François Delfrézy, who is the director of the Agence Nationale de Recherche sur la SIDA, to announce the two award winners of the IAS ANRS Research Prize. This prize is a prize of 3,000 US, which recognizes young researchers who demonstrate excellence in the area of research programs related to the scale-up of prevention and treatment in resource-limited settings. The presenting authors of the winning abstracts must be under 35 years of age and must be a citizen of a low or middle-income country. As well, the research being considered for the award must be carried out in a developing country. The young investigators honored by this prize represent the real hope individuals from areas of the world most impacted by this disease will contribute significantly to eradicating it. So we're really pleased to be here to present these special awards.
Thanks, Hélène. Good morning to everybody. My name is Jean-François Delfrézy, and I'm the director of the NRS. The IAS-ANRS Prize began after the Paris Conference on HIV pathogenesis in 2003. With Michel Kazetskin and Françoise Barrès-Sinoussi, we decided to found a new prize in partnership with IAS for young scientists involved in innovative HIV research in developing countries, particularly in the field of prevention and treatment. ANRS is fully involved in the research with the developing countries. 28% of our budget, 85 active projects are funded by ANRS, and an exhibition in Toronto at the Alliance Française on this topic for the next 2 weeks. The first highest ANRS prize were given in Rio last year. The winners for this year in Toronto are Dorothy Baland from Uganda and Dr. Le Minh Giang from Vietnam. Dr. Baland is a physician with a Master of Public Health. She is involved since 7 years in Uganda in HIV prevention care and clinical support. Dr. Le Minh Giang has a PhD in medical anthropology. His work is involved in HIV risk among young male migrants using heroin in Hanoi, Vietnam, and as you know, is a major issue for Vietnam at that time. Congratulations to both of them.
Thank you so much. This is a wonderful tradition and wonderful to see the future of HIV/AIDS research as represented by this prize. It's now my honor and pleasure to introduce the chairs of this session, and I will introduce all four of the chairs, and then they will be introducing the speakers in order of their presentation. Before we start, just to say we will be keeping strictly to time, we'll need to clear the room immediately after we have a very important session focused on antiretroviral therapy following right after. So we will be as ruthless as possible about keeping everybody on time. The first chair is Mr. Ashok Alexander from the Gates Foundation. Ashok had a very prestigious and successful career in the world of business management and was head of the Delhi office of McKinsey consultant firm, where I had the pleasure to get to know him. At that time I was at the Gates Foundation. We began working on developing a program that he is now the director of, the Abahan program, which looks at reducing the spread of HIV/AIDS in India. He has been the director, he's the inaugural director of that program, and it's really my pleasure to have him here with us today. He's been a real leader in the field of HIV and HIV prevention in the short time that he's been working on it. It's been very gratifying. The next presenter is Lennart Jellmaker, who is the HIV/AIDS ambassador for Sweden. He's an advocate of prevention programs and supporter of the International AIDS Conference for many years. He's been in this position since 2003. Before that, he was the head of the Department for Global Development in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Stockholm. He has also served in different capacities in Africa over the last 10 years, and we had the pleasure of working together on the Global Fund Board. The next chair is Liviana Calzavaro from the University of Toronto. She's an associate professor and deputy director of the University of Toronto. She's also the scientific co-chair for this conference and has really provided excellent leadership in that capacity. And the fourth presenter is, we're honored to have the Minister of Health for France, Xavier Bertrand, who has been the Minister of Health for France since June 2005. So we're really honored to have him with us and honored to have all of our distinguished chairs who will present their speakers in order. Thank you very much.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this plenary session on prevention, proven approaches and new technologies. We have a very exciting panel here, and I know you're looking forward to today's presentations. It's my pleasure to introduce the first of today's speakers, Cristina Pimenta from Brazil. Cristina Pimenta is a psychologist by training at the University of Maryland, has a master's degree in education from George Mason University and a PhD in collective health from the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. Cristina has been executive director of the Brazilian Interdisciplinary AIDS Association since 2002 and has published a number of articles on HIV/AIDS prevention. She also has vast experience in program implementation and monitoring of public policy. Cristina has worked as an international consultant in the field of HIV/AIDS prevention for 15 years and was the head of the prevention unit of the Brazilian National AIDS Program from 1996 to 2000 and again from 2005 to 2006. Cristina.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues and friends. First, I'd like to thank IAS and the organizers of this conference for the invitation to speak here today. And I want also to thank the team from ABIA for their support, and especially Richard Parker and Veriano Terto for their input to this presentation. I'm also very proud to be here today representing Latin American women in the fight against AIDS as a social scientist and as an activist. This is our 16th International AIDS Conference and our 25th year of an HIV/AIDS epidemic. We can look at some of our accomplishments, but we also need to reflect upon the challenges we face. The paradoxes are many. According to the UNAIDS 2006 report on the global AIDS epidemic, we have made progress in controlling the epidemic in a few countries, but unfortunately, also registering growing numbers of infections in most countries. It's estimated that we had 4.1 million new infections in 2005. We have made considerable progress in the areas of AIDS treatment with antiretroviral therapy, reaching 1.3 million people in low and middle income countries, and 21 countries providing treatment to at least 50% of those in need. We have also seen recently that it's possible to mobilize resources globally, but even with these numbers to show for our efforts, we seem to be moving backwards in respect to prevention. HIV prevention programs are failing to reach the most vulnerable populations. The same global report shows that only 9% of men who have sex with men receive any type of prevention service. Less than 20% of injecting drug users receive HIV prevention services. Only 9% of pregnant women were covered with services to prevent HIV infections in infants, and less than 50% of young people worldwide have any significant level of knowledge about HIV and AIDS. These are unacceptable levels of access and coverage, and it shows that the barriers to prevention are many. This brief presentation will review some important prevention paradigms. It will address first social vulnerability as a major factor that shapes the manifestations of the AIDS epidemic, where social and economic conditions and lack of power, especially in age and gender relations, are determinants of social vulnerability. I will look at the intersection of diverse factors of structural inequality which condition the possibilities of risk reduction. Second, it will explore strategies and approaches that can be taken to design and implement more effective prevention programs. Third, it will point out the important barriers that exist of a material, cultural, and political nature that impede access to means of protection and limit availability of prevention programs and methods. Looking at 20 years of experience in designing programs and responses to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, we know today that it makes little sense to talk of human beings and their actions as if they were well-behaved research objects, where consensual behavior models dominate the scene and dictate the norms of action. It became impossible to make an advance in the matter of health promotion through linear discourses and present proposals of pure individual responsibility to support preventive action, as was often done in the 1980s. The multiple dimensions of HIV/AIDS have been known for a long time, and we now know that we need collective approaches to prevention and health promotion for public health. Since the mid-90s, there is wide recognition there's wide recognition that social vulnerability and exclusion is the major factor that influences the growth of the epidemic worldwide. It has become clear that social, cultural, economic characteristics shape the manifestations of the epidemic, which takes on different features in different communities. This is why it's no longer possible to talk about HIV/AIDS prevention and care in terms of simple linear determinants. On vulnerability to HIV/AIDS, studies conducted in different settings emphasize that the concept of vulnerability takes into account the chance of exposure to the disease as a result of a series of aspects that are not only individual, but also collective and contextual, and which increase susceptibility to infection. Thus, several authors recommend an evaluation of individual social and structural components in analyzing the vulnerability factors involving a population, and as an extension of this, consequently, taking interventions and campaigns to the local socialization settings. Poor social and economic conditions and lack of power are determinants of social vulnerability. Nevertheless, there is a tendency today to refer to vulnerability in an essentialist manner, as though it were somehow the natural circumstance of population groups rather than a product of their social and economic exclusion. It is therefore especially important to look at the interrelations and intersection of these vulnerability factors to understand the synergy that often exists between forms of inequality in order to more fully understand the social logic of the epidemic, the ways in which it traverses the multiple fault lines of inequality that exist in different societies. As Dr. Paul Farmer and others pointed out in the mid-90s, the special vulnerability of young women, for example, has been emphasized due to the detrimental effects of unequal gender power relations, which make it exceptionally difficult for women to negotiate safer sexual relations, and which function with special brutality in relation to poor and young women in consequence to the multiple forms of inequality they face, frequently with little control over sexual matters in the relationships, suffering discrimination, abandonment, and violence when sexual issues related to disease prevention and treatment are raised with partners or family members. However, it has clearly been documented that young males also experience heightened levels of STI and HIV infection. The reasons for this increased vulnerability have been less frequently explored. and the steps that might be taken to design and implement more effective programs for the reduction of sexual risk have been, if anything, even more limited than in relation to young women. So there is urgency in considering male-targeted interventions, not only for adult males, but also for male children and youth where gender power relations is addressed in order to enhance the social norms that facilitate gender equality and promotion of human rights. We know that vulnerability factors and risk behaviors are constituted within the context of a socially and culturally constructed sex-gender system, as well as at the point of intersection of diverse factors of structural inequality which condition the possibilities of risk reduction in many interconnected ways. The recognition of the need to intervene in ways that will make it possible for individuals and groups to visualize their social-cultural context more effectively and transform the setting and their relationship to it is seen as a key element in the reduction of risk and vulnerability to disease. This is also true when working prevention issues among HIV-positive persons. In addition to contextual factors, particularly in careful attention to the social-cultural construction and organization of age and gender relations, sexual practices, and the existence of stigma and discrimination around sexuality and HIV/AIDS has increasingly been linked to a focus on education strategies that emphasize reflection and collective empowerment as key strategies for risk reduction. That is, by creating an increased sense of critical awareness in relation to the various contextual factors which structure risk in different settings. Such approaches seek to develop enabling strategies, making it possible for people, especially the very young, to make choices in their lives and manage power in such relations in order to effectively reduce their vulnerability to STI and HIV infection. The aspects of gender relations, cultural and social differences, and stigma and discrimination have to be considered as challenges in most countries. The major task is to understand the social processing of the rituals of gender interaction, social inequalities, identities, and networks. The existing combination of stigmas related to HIV/AIDS and gender, race, sexuality, and poverty is also an important factor to be looked at for both our understanding of the social responses to the epidemic as to create concrete strategies and actions in order to diminish or eliminate its effects. As Parker and Angleton have pointed out in their work, regardless of its nature, stigma and discrimination related to sexuality, HIV/AIDS, TB and malaria threatens solidarity and social mobilization that are essential components for the implementation of a participatory and inclusive sustainable response towards health promotion. Programmatic priorities should take the social and economic context of the population into consideration. We need to address situations of physical violence as well as structural violence, to recognize the fine line that exists between meeting basic life needs, exposure to urban violence related to crime in general and drug trafficking especially, and risk of HIV infection, a line that has become extremely narrow, especially among the poorer classes, which constitutes severe situations of lack of alternatives, especially for the very young. But there are also situations of sexual violence, trafficking of people, and violence related to intolerance of sexual diversity against homosexual men and women and transgender persons. In order to overcome the barriers for open discussion related to people's sexual and reproductive health and drug use practices related to HIV prevention, and construct new prevention paradigms, we must seriously consider the diversity of social experiences with emphasis on details as to class, gender, ethnicity, religional diversity, and insertion and belonging to specific social and cultural groups, in addition to the different life experiences within these groups. Individual and couple sexual behavior emerges from socially and culturally determined understandings of what is appropriate for and expected of males and females. In the present context of the AIDS epidemic, where unprotected sexual interactions may have detrimental health consequences, these gender expectations and attitudes are of particular importance. In this respect, some recommendations for research interventions are: first, to examine youth and adolescence as a formative phase that determines the social arrangements of the man or woman and of becoming an adult. Second, enhance the focus at gender relations per se, rather than just focus on masculine and or feminine needs. Consider the diversities of sexual orientation and their gender implications. Investigate the organization of gender relations in the specific culture in order to understand violence between the sexes and contribute to building strategies that make gender relations more equitable and workable. Third, research interventions should be conducted to understand and combat the role of structural violence, poverty, racism, and other forms of social exclusion as one of the principal factors behind the vulnerability to HIV/AIDS, and implement multidisciplinary research that combines economic, social, and medical sciences. We know how the virus is transmitted and how the transmission can be prevented. So we now need to promote prevention programs that are based on new prevention paradigms. Prevention paradigms that move from purely behavioral approaches that focus on individual processes to constructive approaches that focus on collective processes and foster collective responses. That promote multi-sectoral responses through the construction of alliances and partnerships and establish co-responsibility of actions in public health. Approaches that have a health and human rights perspective, meaning that prevention programs and actions have to further respect for a person's specific condition and vulnerability to HIV and other sexually transmitted infections, and promote non-discrimination of persons living with HIV, as well as non-discrimination due to sexual diversity, ethnicity, gender or age, or drug use. Approaches that combat violence against women and children, violence against homosexuals and transgender persons and sex workers. Approaches that promote community education and long-standing partnership with the most vulnerable and intensifies real involvement and support of the most affected populations, and that considers the social and economic circumstances, religious, sexual and drug-taking practices of the population that are age and gender specific and, most important, that are inclusive. Approaches that focus on strategies that emphasize critical reflection and collective empowerment as key strategies for risk reduction and that promote and provide access to scientifically proven preventive measures. Approaches that address the importance of linking prevention to treatment and care as part of an integral approach to prevention, where an integrated health care approach is a fundamental principle and prevention, treatment, and care are seen as a continuum and not as distinct and separate approaches to health care. In summary, prevention paradigms need to be based on principles of human rights and community organization, promote structural changes related to social marginalization, economic exclusion, and violence, as well as promote the adoption of safer health practices for the prevention of HIV infection and treatment. Protection of human rights has to be addressed through national legislature and implementation of local policies. In concentrated epidemics, specific strategies and interventions should be focused primarily to the limited populations, but nevertheless, prevention and services have also to be made available and accessible to all. Under generalized epidemics, on the other hand, there is need to implement strategies that consider broad frameworks that include a wide range of interventions for both men and women of all ages in order to reach the entire country's population, making prevention, education, diagnostic and treatment services available to all, but also include targeted services to the most vulnerable and at risk of infection, especially among the poorer segments of the population. Looking at the barriers to prevention efforts, we know that different levels and forms of information about HIV transmission are available in most countries, but that actual communication and direct exchange on matters related to sex, sexuality, drug use, and gender relations don't take place. Efforts to increase knowledge of HIV, sexual and reproductive health among young people are still inadequate and insufficient. We have also to recognize that important barriers exist of material, cultural, and political nature that limit access to means of protection, especially with respect to condom and harm reduction equipment. And most importantly, is that these barriers are posed today by informed national governments as well as international donor agencies. In addition, reluctance among public officials to expose the scale of their AIDS epidemic and conservative political and religious trends also continues to fuel the epidemic in most affected regions. harmonization of legislative frameworks and policies to provide social support and protection to affected individuals and families, to confront stigma, fight discrimination towards an accelerated HIV response remains weak and inadequate and are serious challenges for effective prevention programs. If there's real commitment by the international community, by public health officials, scientists, the organized civil society and governments to fight this epidemic, we cannot close our eyes and pretend there's no effective means to do so. We can make use of scientifically proven methods. First, blood screening, biomedical safety measures, post-exposure prophylaxis, use of male and female condoms for prevention of sexual transmission, use of harm reduction interventions, including substitution therapies when applicable, information and counseling treatment. In addition, other potentially promising biomedical interventions and methods, when proven effective and made available for the wide public use, such as microbicides, pre-exposure prophylaxis, and adult male circumcision, should be considered as complementary preventive measures for the transmission of HIV, but not as standalone or absolute solutions. We need to remember that technical biomedical interventions are also context-specific, where socio-economic, cultural, and epidemiological aspects of the population need to be considered. In addition to the information, education, and motivational levels of that community when applying them, biomedical interventions can never be implemented in a social and political vacuum. This is not to minimize the need to accelerate research for the development of preventive vaccines and other new prevention technologies and tools. But careful thought must be directed at the present trend towards the medicalization of prevention within the international discourses and responses to the AIDS epidemic, and the present tendency to see biomedical interventions as quick technical magical solutions to the HIV-AIDS prevention. What is particularly worrisome is when attention to supposedly quick new technical solutions seems to deflect or redirect attention away from the fundamentally political barriers that have been erected in recent years by some governments and agencies, impeding the implementation of proven effective educational approaches such as condom use and harm reduction, that in some circles have apparently become politically objectionable. Unfortunately, the most effective antiretroviral therapies we have available today are still not a solution to HIV infection, nor a cure for AIDS. Millions of people are still dying of AIDS. Treatment-related side effects and health debilitating events, in addition to adherence problems, are cumulative and of extreme concern for those under treatment. Thus, prevention is still the best solution. Any serious prevention policy and program has to promote condom use for prevention of sexual transmission and harm reduction measures, as effective and realistic procedures to be implemented by national and local governments. And this has to be done with the involvement of civil society, and in particular with the participation of the most affected populations. If prevention efforts are to be universally accessible by 2010, in addition to confronting inequality and social oppression, national and international AIDS responses must advocate for universal availability of condoms, sterile needles and syringes for IV drug users, the promotion and protection of human rights, and access to diagnosis and treatment services, in addition to information and education that is gender and age sensitive. As a final word, I would like to say that regardless of the dynamics of the epidemic in different countries and the vulnerability factors involved, there's urgent need to link primary, secondary prevention and STI and HIV treatment efforts in order to effectively scale up prevention and deliver serious action to prevent new infections and control the AIDS epidemic. We need to confront inequality and social oppression and aim for full human development. In a world which some of us are living with HIV/AIDS, we are all living with HIV/AIDS, and it's only when we realize the integral connection between prevention and treatment, the connection that links us together as part of a broader struggle, a struggle for solidarity, will we truly be able to confront the challenge that has been posed by this terrible epidemic. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. Christina Pimenta has reminded us all about the need to approach the HIV prevention from a broad perspective, addressing both the need for new technologies and the need to address the environment, the social and economic context where evidence-based prevention activities will and should take place. I believe that her presentation gave us all a very good framework for this session on prevention. And it now gives me the pleasure to introduce the second speaker, Professor Geeta Ramji from South Africa. The title of Professor Ramji's presentation will be Microbicides and Other Prevention Technologies. Professor Geeta Ramji is the director of the South African Medical Research Council, HIV and AIDS Lead Program, and the director of the MRC HIV Prevention Research Unit. Professor Ramji is involved in numerous international research programs and clinical trials in the field of HIV prevention. Professor Ramji is the principal investigator of three phase 3 and one phase 2b microbicide trials. One phase 3 trial on vaginal diaphragm and a trial to test the effectiveness of short course ARV therapy at HIV-1 seroconversion. She and her team of 240 researchers and support staff are involved in the testing of 5 out of 6 microbicide products that have reached this advanced stage of development. Professor Ramji is a long-standing contributor to the International AIDS Conference, having served as committee member and reviewer of abstracts. She was also the co-chair of the recent Microbicides 2006 conference, which took place in South Africa, and is a track chair for the upcoming EIS conference in Australia in 2007. Professor Ramji's research interests focus on HIV prevention, on women-initiated prevention options, such as microbicides, as well as treatment and care research in HIV-positive populations. Professor Ramji received her PhD at the University of Natal, South Africa in 1994, and was awarded a distinguished visiting professorship by the Tamil Nadu Medical University in India in 2005. It's now my pleasure to give you the floor, Professor Ramji.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk in this very important conference. 25 years into the epidemic, and we still have alarmingly high number of HIV infections every year. There are several proven prevention approaches, such as behavioral changes, which includes the classic abstinence, be faithful, and condomize both male and female condoms. We have voluntary counseling and testing, and we have treatment of sexually transmitted infections. But the good news is that a range of new and promising technologies are in advanced clinical trials, and these include vaginal microbicides, cervical barriers such as vaginal diaphragms, male circumcision, exposure to exposure prophylaxis, which includes both pre and post, and HSV2 suppressive therapy, and the ultimate prize, that's the vaccine. For the purpose of this talk today, I'm going to focus on all the yellow highlighted technologies on my slide. And the focus of the talk will be on technologies that are currently the theoretical basis of the technology, the current status of the clinical trials, and some of the challenges that we are facing during these prevention trials. Bill and Melinda Gates alluded to the urgent need of HIV prevention, HIV prevention among women, and microbicides will be just doing that, will giving the woman power to prevent HIV infections. And what are their potential for prevention HIV? These are chemical products which are currently formulated as gels and which can be applied in the vagina to prevent HIV infection. They are female initiated, so the woman will have the power whether to inform or not to inform her partner whether she is using them or not. And early research is also ongoing on rectal microbicides. Compelling evidence for microbicides as a HIV prevention tools come from monkey studies, and this data here on my slide shows exactly the two studies, animal studies, which show have the compelling evidence that microbicide may just work. So how do these microbicides work? there are several mechanisms through which macrobicide could prevent HIV infection. The first way is by they would act as a physical barrier between HIV and the target cells. They could maintain normal microflora in the vagina. They could prevent sexually transmitted infection. They could also disrupt viral disruption, and therefore making the virus unable to infect. And more recently, we're testing fusion attachment inhibitors, which actually prevent the virus from attaching to the target cells in the vagina. And more recently, and very exciting concept, is the use of antiretrovirals as microbicides that would actually prevent establishment of the infections in the body. So what kind of microbicide would we like? We would like a microbicide which has a high anti-HIV activity. We want something that has low toxicity. We want a safe microbicide. We want something that acts against other sexually transmitted infection. And we want to give the woman the option to have a baby without having an infection. So we want a contraceptive or a non-contraceptive microbicide. The current products that are currently being tested in the first generation products is the products that I've mentioned here, the acid buffer, entry inhibitors, and surfactants. They have some contraceptive properties. They are specific to HIV, but not highly specific to HIV. They do not have any systemic absorption, which is a good thing. And majority of them are coitally dependent. That means that the product has to be inserted in the vagina prior to sexual intercourse. Now, the new generation of microbicides that are currently in early stages of testing are the ARV-containing microbicides called tenofovir and TMC-120. They will not be contraceptive. However, they will have more specificity towards HIV. They may or may not be systemically absorbed, and we do not know much about the coital dependency. So what is the microbicide development pipeline? As you can see from the number of dots here, there are many, many products in early concept stage, and there are 30 to 40 candidates in preclinical development and 14 in early safety trials and 5, as I mentioned, in clinical large-scale efficacy trials. Not many products make it from early concept stage right up to efficacy trials. So there's a lot of hard work that goes into getting the products from concept to efficacy trials. This is the map showing the global overview of the current phase 2B and 3 clinical trials. As you can imagine, the majority of the trials are being conducted in sub-Saharan Africa, where the HIV infection rates are the highest among women in the world. And also, this is the region where the microbicides will be needed the most. And the products that are currently being tested are Caragard, cellulose sulfate, 2 concentrations of Pro-2000 in one trial, Pro-2000 against buffer gel in another trial, and C31G in one trial. So as you can see from the key here, these are the trials happening. So for example, the cellulose sulfate is happening in West Africa, East Africa, and South Africa, and in India. The Caragard trial is being conducted in South Africa. The 2.5% Pro-2000 is in East and Southern Africa. Buffer gel and 0.5% again in Southern Africa and Philadelphia, and C31G here in West Africa. So in terms of the status of these clinical trials, where are we? As you can see from the left-hand corner, majority of these trials are funded by the public sector funds and philanthropic organizations. There is no private sector funding. Trials that are being conducted are listed here, and this is the recruitment status of each of the trials that I've just mentioned. And if you look at the column here, the HIV prevalence among the women that we are recruiting in clinical trials ranges from 9% in West Africa to about 55% in South Africa. And this particular prevalence data emphasizes the urgent need for women-initiated options for these countries. It also emphasizes the fact that we cannot do prevention research without even addressing treatment and care in these communities. The good news is that many of these trials are well advanced and the first results will be out in end of 2007. So we are not a long way away before we get to know at least whether the first microbicide works or not. Sorry, there's a problem with the slide. Okay. What are the new developments in microbicides? As I mentioned, they are ARV-containing microbicides, which are going to be more specific and longer acting. And then, as the current formulation is vaginal microbicide gel, we are now working towards getting another formulation, which is a vaginal ring. And here we may think that it may have a more potentially reduced compliance, will be easy to use, and it may be inserted in the vagina for more than 30 days. Now, this is in early stages, and we think that we're planning, the international partnership of microbicide is planning acceptability studies in several cities in Africa. So what are the key challenges in microbicide research? What we have is the problem is that we do not have a clear marker, a biological marker of protection. So all clinical trials that are currently testing has to have HIV as the endpoint. Adherence to product use. We will only be able to assess whether the product works or not if we can measure adherence. However, adherence, as you all know, is based on self-reported data, and we do not know how much of the product is actually used or not. In terms of trial conduct, I know that I work with 5 phase 3 clinical trials, and there are huge challenges in the field, such as pregnancy, retention rates, HIV incidence, and cost. I'll just go through briefly what pregnancy issues we have. Currently, in the trials that we are doing, the pregnancy incidence is very high. That means that women who are participating in clinical trials are taken off the product. And this actually has a huge impact on the statistical power of the study to show efficacy. And therefore, pregnancy becomes a major issue. And a lot of us working in the field are working through strategies like introduction of contraception at the trial sites to address this problem. Retention rate, in any clinical trial, retention rates have to be very high in order to show efficacy. And in the current trials, we're aiming for a retention rate between 90 and 95%. And that's huge when we're doing trials in developing countries where the terrain is not very, terrain is hard and it's not easily accessible. So retention becomes a huge problem. And if you lose a large proportion of women, then it impacts on your trial as well. HIV incidence. Prior to study implementations, many sponsors and the investigators estimated the HIV incidence in many of these sites where the trials are happening. But what happened is that the incidence is much lower than what was predicted. And remember, it was predicted. There were not many cohort studies undertaken to measure actual incidence. And therefore, when the incidence is lower, that means that you have to now change your trial design, recruit more women, and that has huge cost implications. Ethics and care obligations. And I've just mentioned that the HIV prevalence in the countries that we work in is huge. So we cannot ignore the issue of care. And we need to know what the standard of care package will be for those that are screened out as well as those who seroconvert. Many of us who work in the field have developed strategies where we are facilitating care for those women who screen out as well as those who seroconvert in the trial. And this can only happen if you have partnership with your local government and the local service provider. I just want to stress that I'm not going to repeat this key challenges in all the trials that I'm presenting today, but these apply to many of the phase 3 trials that I'm going to mention. I just would like to mention the microbicide development strategy. A group of donors have come together to develop this strategy for microbicide, and the purpose is to take stock of the current status of the field, identify gaps, and build consensus on current research and development priorities. And I think it's a very important step to ensure that there is a cohesive development and taking through of products into clinical trials. The next potential HIV prevention technology I'm going to talk about is the cervical barrier. This, again, is a women-initiated method that has been proven to be safe, effective, and acceptable contraceptive. And the theoretical basis is that if the upper genital tract may be more susceptible to HIV infection, so if you cover the cervix, then you may reduce the risk of HIV infection. And observational studies in the past have shown that covering the cervix reduces the risk of HIV in STIs. So what is the status of cervical barrier trials? Currently, there's one phase three clinical trial funded by through UCSF by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And this is the method for improving reproductive health in Africa, vaginal diaphragm. And this is a diaphragm that is being used with, together with replenished gel. The sample size here is 5,045, and the study has been undertaken in Durban, Johannesburg, and in Harare, Zimbabwe. The HIV prevalence, again, you will see this trend all the time, very high, 32% in these countries. The trial status, the recruitment is complete, and the study is going to end next month, and we're hoping the results to be out in June 2007. So it's not a long wait. Male circumcision for HIV prevention. And there's been a lot of interest in this particular concept. Biological data shows that HIV, men who are circumcised has a reduced risk of HIV infection. And this happens due to the removal of the target cells from the foreskin of the penis, and then further keratinization of the penile surface increases the rapid drying, which decreases the risk of STI. Epidemiological evidence comes from studies which shows that males who have been circumcised have a lower HIV prevalence, and a meta-analysis by Weiss proposed that in many African countries where men were circumcised, the HIV risk was low. So where are we with clinical trials? Male circumcision clinical trials. There was one trial from South Africa by Obert et al., which showed that men in the randomized control trial, men who were randomized to have an operation of circumcision had a lower risk of HIV, and the risk was reduced by 60%. However, with all scientific data, we have to confirm this data with other clinical trials. And there are three clinical trials already on the way, and two of them are in Uganda, one in Kenya. And this is the status of the trial. And the good news again, that 2007-2008 is going to be a very good year for prevention. And the challenges we faced here is, again, you know, introducing safety. And what is the safety of male circumcision? What are the ethical challenges? And what are the cultural and religious acceptability in the communities that we're going to work in? And the biggest challenge is that if the other trials show efficacy, how are we going to take such an intervention from evidence-based research to public health action. Moving on to the next technology, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis as a potential for HIV prevention. The proof of concept exists here in malaria and MTCT, preventing mother-to-child transmission. Scientists have recognized two antiretrovirals, tenofovir and Truvada, which is 3TC and tenofovir, as a potential for PrEP studies. And this is based on their good safety profile in AIDS treatment and, more importantly, on the once-a-day regimen. What is the status of the PrEP clinical trials? There are three clinical trials that are sponsored by CDC, and they are in Thailand, USA, and Botswana. And the current status is they're going to end in 2008. the NIH-funded trial of Truvada with FTC and TDS is going to end. It hasn't started yet in Peru, and we expect it to take 20 months from start to finish. And the Gates Foundation study with oral tenofovir study, which was conducted in three cities in West Africa, Ghana, Cameroon, and Nigeria, has ended, and the results will be presented at the late breaker session. So what are the key challenges in PrEP trials? We need to consider the implication of breakthrough infections with resistant viruses for future therapy options. What is the level of adherence required? How are we going to measure how much to take and whether people are taking the medication appropriately? How would we monitor adverse events? And would it be acceptable to take chronic medication for otherwise healthy people? And what is the potential, and we need to safeguard against this, is the potential for abuse of PrEP among those people who refuse to and do not want to use condoms. Moving on to HSV2, suppressive therapy as a potential for HIV prevention. We know from many, many studies that HSV2 increases the risk of HIV infections. It also increases the risk of HIV transmission. And it impacts on the natural, HIV impacts on the natural history of HSV2, and many studies have shown that HSV2 is also associated with increase in HIV viral load. So the theoretical basis here is that if HSV2 increases susceptibility and infectiousness of HIV, if we treat HSV2, we may reduce the incidence of HIV. So that's the theoretical basis as to why we should introduce HSV2 as a suppressive therapy. So where are we with clinical trials of HSV2? There's two trials. One is the HBTN-039 funded by NIH, and the other is the Gates-funded Partners in Prevention trial. And as you can see, the first one is measuring susceptibility to HIV, and the other one is infectiousness of. And the first trial is happening at 9 sites, and the enrollment is complete, and we're expecting the results in late 2007. The Partners in Prevention trial is being conducted at 14 sites in Africa, and 70% of enrollment is complete, and again, we're expecting results end of 2008. So what are the challenges here? Similar to all the clinical trials that I've mentioned so far, adherence will be an issue. Whether we have to have continuous and episodic treatment and potential for emergence of HIV. I just want to rush through the impact of these technologies on HIV prevention. Microbicides, male circumcision, they would have a huge impact on prevention. And one needs to consider the collective response. So what are the challenges? The future challenges in HIV prevention, I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to go through all of them, but there are public health challenges, as you can quickly read through them, implementation challenges, and more importantly, future research challenges. We as scientists will have to work together in a manner to collaborate to put the best product forward in order to get an effective product in the future. So ladies and gentlemen, to recap, I've mentioned that there are existing prevention technologies, and we're going to add to this mix a range of new technologies which may show promise in prevention. And this can only be done if we have this can be only enhanced by synergistic use of social, behavioral, biomedical, and barrier method. And this can only happen with community involvement and leadership at all levels. Thank you. A few years ago, I chatted to an AIDS expert in Durban, and he said, and I asked him about HIV prevention. And he said to me, HIV prevention is as simple as ABC. And we all know what ABC is. But ladies and gentlemen, I stand before you today, and I would like to believe that HIV prevention soon will be more than ABC. We will add one more C for circumcision. We will add D for diaphragm, E for exposure prophylaxis, S for female controlled options, G for genital tract infections, H for HSV2 suppression, and I for vaccines through immunity. Thank you. I would like to thank everyone listed on this slide for their contribution to the data that I've presented. But I would especially like to thank Slim Abdul Karim, who helped me finalize this slide. Thank you very much.
Mesdames et Messieurs, je voudrais vous lire un message de Jacques Chirac, président de la République française. Mesdames et Messieurs, 25 ans après l'apparition de la maladie, l'épidémie du sida continue de s'étendre. La majorité des 5 millions de nouveaux cas enregistrés l'an dernier l'a été dans le monde en développement et en particulier l'Afrique, qui continue à payer le lourd tribut de ce fléau. L'épidémie apparaît plus que jamais comme l'une des faces dramatiques de la mondialisation. Une mondialisation source d'opportunités et de prospérité, mais qui n'a cependant pas permis à des centaines de millions de femmes et d'hommes de sortir de la pauvreté, de la faim, de l'ignorance et de la maladie. Contre le sida, la communauté internationale a pris deux engagements. Assurer, d'ici 2010, l'accès au traitement à tous ceux qui en ont besoin. Et inverser, d'ici 2015, la progression de l'épidémie. Que la majorité des malades soit au sud, alors que l'accès aux moyens de prévention et aux traitements reste très largement au nord, est moralement inacceptable. La communauté internationale se doit de tenir ses engagements. Pour y parvenir, il faut relever quatre défis. Le premier est celui des ressources, les moyens importants, consentis depuis vos réunions précédentes de Barcelone et de Bangkok, demeurent insuffisants au regard des besoins estimés par l'ONU SIDA. Accroître les ressources passe d'abord par une augmentation de l'aide publique au développement et de la part qui en est dévolue à la santé. La France, pour ce qui la concerne, portera en 2007 à 300 millions d'euros sa contribution au Fonds mondial, devenu le premier instrument multilatéral de financement de la prévention et du traitement du sida, de la tuberculose et du paludisme dans le monde en développement. Accroître les ressources requiert également la mise en place de nouveaux mécanismes de financement, indexés sur la croissance de la richesse mondiale, afin de garantir des moyens additionnels et pérennes. Tel est l'objectif de la contribution de solidarité sur les billets d'avion, entrée en vigueur en France au 1er juillet de cette année, et dont l'essentiel du produit sera affecté au projet United, facilité internationale d'achat de médicaments, à laquelle le Brésil, le Chili, la Norvège et le Royaume-Uni ont déjà accepté de contribuer. En solvabilisant la demande à long terme et en apportant ainsi aux industriels du médicament la visibilité dont ils ont besoin, ce mécanisme incitera de nouveaux producteurs à venir sur le marché et permettra aussi de consolider la baisse des prix. Les médicaments génériques ont joué un rôle déterminant dans cette baisse. La communauté internationale s'est engagée à en faciliter l'accès. Aussi, interdisons-nous dès lors de demander aux pays pauvres de renoncer dans des accords bilatéraux à ce que les accords de l'OMC ont pu leur apporter. Le deuxième défi est celui de l'accès universel à la prévention et au traitement. Les programmes mis en place dans de nombreux pays d'Afrique, d'Asie et d'Amérique latine montrent clairement que l'accès au traitement à grande échelle dans le monde en développement est possible, que l'efficacité des traitements y est la même que celle que nous connaissons dans les pays industrialisés et que traiter les malades du sida concourt aussi au développement économique des pays pauvres. Véritablement changer d'échelle implique d'aider les pays du Sud à renforcer leur système de santé et à faire face aussi à la crise aiguë des ressources humaines à laquelle ils sont confrontés. Dans la plupart des pays du Sud, le coût des soins reste à la charge des personnes malades. et fait basculer chaque année des millions de familles dans la pauvreté. Sur une proposition de la France, le sommet de Saint-Pétersbourg a décidé de lancer une réflexion internationale sur des mécanismes d'assurance maladie dans les pays les plus pauvres. Le troisième défi est celui du respect des droits de l'homme, de la lutte contre le déni et la discrimination. Nul ne saurait être exclu de l'accès à la prévention et aux soins en raison de son mode de vie ou de son appartenance à tel ou tel groupe de population. La France refuse toute tentative d'établir des discriminations à cet égard qui seraient contraires aux principes fondamentaux des droits de l'homme. Et je veux saluer le courage des femmes et des hommes qui, partout dans le monde, luttent pour la dignité et les droits des personnes malades. Le quatrième défi, au cœur de vos débats, est celui de la recherche, effort qu'il faut poursuivre et approfondir dans tous les domaines pertinents à l'épidémie. Je pense en premier lieu à la recherche sur le vaccin, qui requiert de nouveaux modes de coopération internationale. La France, avec ses partenaires européens, entend prendre toute cette part à cette mobilisation. Mesdames et messieurs, la lutte contre le sida est un combat pour la vie, pour la justice, pour la dignité humaine et le développement. Vos succès collectifs soulèvent l'espérance. Ensemble, faisons qu'elle se réalise. Je vous remercie. Mesdames et messieurs, j'ai le plaisir de vous présenter ma concitoyenne, le professeur Françoise Barré-Sinoussi. Elle est le directeur de l'unité biologique des rétrovirus à l'Institut Pasteur de Paris. Engagée dans la recherche sur les rétrovirus depuis le début des années 70, elle est le premier auteur, en 1983, d'une publication rapportant la découverte d'un rétrovirus appelé plus tard HIV. Reconnue pour ses contributions dans la recherche depuis les années 80, elle est l'auteur ou le co-auteur de nombreuses publications ou articles sur le sujet et elle est membre de nombreux comités scientifiques en France et dans d'autres pays. Elle est aussi fortement engagée dans la promotion d'une intégration de la recherche sur le VIH-SIDA avec les actions dans les pays du Sud. Françoise, je vous en prie.
Merci, Monsieur le Ministre, Mesdames, Messieurs les Présidents de séance, Mesdames, Messieurs, chers collègues, bonjour. And I will move now to English. Mr. Minister, Mr. and Mrs. Co-Chair, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, I would like to first to thank all the organizers to invite me to give this talk on HIV vaccine research. It's not an easy task, in fact. What I would like to do is to share with you my own view as a non-HIV vaccine researcher on the dynamics of HIV vaccine science since the identification of HIV-AIDS disease 25 years ago. Let me thank the organization and colleagues who provided me with information for this talk. My thanks will go to Rosé Esparza and Michel Kazachkin for the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise, Wen Koff and the IAV, Yves Lévy and the ANRS, and Frédéric Tanguy at the Institut Pasteur. The dynamic of HIV vaccine research could be considered as successive dreams and nightmares, summarized on next slide. The successive dreams and nightmares that I show here are indeed summarizing all the vaccine trials that have been done with failures and very limited success, I must say, up to now. This story started in 1987 with the first phase one trial. Since then, more than 85 phase 1-2 trials have been conducted with more than 30 candidates and more than 30 trials are still ongoing. They have shown that candidates are safe and are at least are partially immunogenic. In 2003, data of the first phase 3 efficacy trial were reported, definitively proving that the recombinant GP120 used as a candidate in this trial was not protecting against the infection and was not even reducing viral replication. Since the AIDS conference in Bangkok 2 years ago, additional trials have been launched. 2 efficacy trials are ongoing with data expected by 2008-2009, and new ones will probably be conducted according to some encouraging data from phase 1-2 trials. In addition, new vaccine candidates have been designed. Indeed, if we analyze the vaccine strategy that has been used up to now, they are indeed very traditional with fluctuation over the past 20 years in terms of immune responses that vaccine researchers are trying to induce to block the infection by neutralizing antibodies or to eliminate infected cells by HIV-specific T-cell immunity. This graph that I show here is indeed presenting the percentage of publication reporting neutralizing antibody or T-cell responses to immunization within 5-year interval between 1983 and 2006. As you can see, initially vaccine researchers were trying mostly to induce neutralizing antibody response.
International Youth Leadership Council and the Youth Council
was on strengthening and broadening the T-cell response, then on both, trying to induce both response with a new interest recently on antibody-mediated immunity. Indeed, one should recognize that all these approaches can be considered as quite of more of the same approach, only changing the candidates to try to achieve the goal in terms of design response. The principal vaccine candidates used to reach this goal were recombinant proteins, in particular GP120 or GP160 subunit vaccine to induce neutralizing antibody. Multiple other vectors has been and are in use too, like poxvirus, like adenovirus, measles, alpha virus, as well as DNA, or synthetic peptide immunization, like the lipopeptide strategy used by our National Agency for AIDS and Hepatitis Virus Research in France. The prime boost strategy using a combination of candidates in particular to induce both B and T cell response has been and is still widely considered. As I said earlier, some encouraging data in terms of immunogenicity have been obtained with some of these approaches, and it's certainly worthwhile to conduct and launch new vaccine trials. However, we must recognize that up to now, the design of vaccine candidates has been mostly empirical design without enough scientific rationale. Why? Simply because to develop novel and rational strategy, we need to improve our knowledge on how vaccines work. Indeed, 12 out of the 16 effective and approved antiviral vaccines are against acute infection, but not against persistent infection. Only 4 are against persistent infection. Moreover, against DNA viruses, like the recently approved vaccine against papilloma virus infection. How they work? We only partially know how to answer to this question, and certainly among the priority to improve our knowledge on the protecting mechanism by which this vaccine works, in addition to no correlates of protection that remain correlates. The reality number one is among the first gaps that we are encountering for HIV/AIDS vaccine research summarized on the next slide. The second gap is the lack of novel and applicable new concepts derived from fundamental immunology. The third one is indeed related to the second one, is our insufficient knowledge of the very complex crosstalk between components of the innate and adaptive immunity. This is a critical issue. However, this field is really moving fast today, and I'm convinced that HIV/AIDS research will strongly benefit of the most recent and continuing progress in immunology. The fourth scientific gap is represented by key scientific challenges in HIV/AIDS that are presented in the next two slides. Of course, the genetic diversity of HIV that I illustrated by this map presented last year in Rio by Francine McCutcheon is certainly one key challenge, with all the subtypes and recombinant forms of viruses circulating worldwide. But we should remember, it is not the only one. We should also keep in mind that this virus is infecting functional cells of our immune defense, like, of course, the CD4 lymphocyte, but also antigen-presenting cells, such as macrophages and dendritic cells. Another key challenge is the spreading of the virus from cells to cells that should be protected by vaccine. The integration of HIV genome into host cells and the capacity of this virus to persist into host cells at effector immune sites, including mucosal sites, are obviously challenging too. Other key challenges are represented by the functional alteration of immune cells, infected or not, mediated by HIV, and the very rapid induction of altered signal in response to HIV that contrasts with the slow response in specific immunity. Finally, the limitation in animal models are also an issue that certainly contributes to delay the progress in HIV vaccine research. It's clear that to overcome all these key challenges, further basic research in immunology and in HIV/AIDS pathogenesis is urgently needed. Despite these complex challenges and this complex reality, there is hope in future. The first hope is in the fantastic recent progress in our knowledge of HIV pathogenesis, in particular of the very early events occurring after infection. Among these, the early massive infection of depletion and CD4 plus cells in the gut, the strong correlation between intense and generalized T-cell activation and disease progression, as well as the innate control of HIV infection, should be considered. They all have very serious implications in HIV vaccine research. As you can see on this slide, we are learning a lot from patients themselves living with HIV and the heart, as well as from the low proportion of patients, so-called HIV elicit controllers, or the long-term non-progressors that have a strong T-cell response in favor of vaccine eliciting T-cell immunity. but our understanding of why these patients are naturally developing such a good response remains to be improved. African non-human primates, such as African green monkeys, chimpanzees, manga bees, mandrills, are also very useful models, in particular to gain insight into the determinants and mechanisms of protection against disease progression, since they do not develop AIDS in opposite to human or macaques. For example, African green monkeys and manga bees do not show any sign of generalized T-cell activation, and several reports indicate distinct early responses in infected monkey compared to human and macaques. Recently, my own laboratory, Michaela Müller-Trudwin, and her collaborators found that in African green monkeys, the early balance in response to SIV infection is in favor of anti-inflammatory profile with early signal like TGF-beta, FOXP3, IL-10, interferon alpha, and even more recently SMAD4, that might become important markers for protection against disease evolution in the future. One hypothesis that we should work further on is on the next slide. This hypothesis is that HIV or HIV determinants might alter the early signaling pathways that imply crosstalk between three critical players of the specific immune response: the natural killer cells, NK, the dendritic cells, and the T cells. Such defect might indeed result in generalized T cell activations that correlate with disease progression. Again, here innate immunity might play a key role in this process, and indeed the next slide shows that we have already evidences that NK response to the infection might be involved. For example, an expansion of non-functional NK cell subset is observed in viremic patients in contrast to the persistence of functional NK cells reported in non-pathogenic infection. In addition, Patrice Debré's lab reported that a motif of HIV-1 GP41 stimulates the expression of a ligand of NK cells on CD4 cells from infected patients, which consequently might play a critical role in CD4 T cell depletion. Several other reports indicate modulation of the NK ligand repertoire in HIV infection and or indicate the impact of the host genetic polymorphism on NK response. The study of Danielle Scott, Algara, and my lab in collaboration with Pascal Paul and Vietnamese colleagues also provide evidence that NK cells may play a role in protecting against HIV infection. As illustrated in this slide here, the high level of constitutive NK cell activation that indeed is observed in exposed non-infected Vietnamese individuals compared to HIV-positive individuals or to blood donors strengthen this idea of protection of NK cells. Again, this need for further research on innate immunity. The next hope is therapeutic vaccine. Therapeutic vaccines are to stimulate and to restore the long-term memory T and B cell specific response and consequently to better control the infection in chronically infected patients on ART. In addition, this approach provides information on correlates of protection. This approach has been first used in primate models with encouraging results. In human, more than 15 trials have been conducted to evaluate the capacity of therapeutic immunization to control virus replication, either after heart discontinuation or during the follow-up. Mixed data were obtained, but some were encouraging, in particular in vaccinated patients on heart with subsequent treatment interruption. Next slide illustrates some such encouraging data. The NRS 093 trial was done on patients that were randomized to receive either heart alone or combined with a vaccination strategy based on canary pox and lipopeptide immunization followed by 3 cycles of interleukin 2. The impact of the vaccination was assessed by stopping heart in patients once their viral load was below 250, and the impact of the vaccination was evaluated by the duration of time without heart. As you can see on this slide, at the end of the study, 38% of vaccinated patients and 90% of control patients did not meet the criteria for heart resumption. This study indicates that a significant reduction in exposure to heart can be achieved through therapeutic vaccination. It is worthwhile to notice that this was strongly associated to CD4 and T cell response in vaccinated patients. I would like to also, in addition to this scientific hopes in the future, to add one. The concepts of global commitment to transparency and enhanced collaboration and HIV vaccine research launched in 2003 through the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise. Since then, a scientific plan has been written by 140 scientists from 15 countries with 5 priorities, which are listed here on this slide, defined. This commitment is also to increase resources and to improve collaboration between researchers. Since 2005, members of the Global Vaccine Enterprise have implemented new initiatives that are summarized on the next slide. These initiatives are first the Center for HIV Vaccine Immunology launched by NIH. The second one is the Gates Foundation for multiple research centers and consortia, and other initiatives have been also been taken by IAV. They are all listed on this slide. Action and recommendation made by the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise member are presented in the AIDS Vaccine Blueprint 2006 version of IAV. They include rational vaccine design, collaborative scientific empiries, new models for AIDS vaccine trials, and of course, capacity building. This requires access to dedicated vaccine and development infrastructure, sustained and expanded political mobilization and commitment at all levels, long-term financing, addressing key policy issues now, and management of expectations. I would like now to give you the take-home message of my talk at the end of this presentation. We should keep in mind that future HIV vaccine strategy should be based on novel and creative scientific concepts. The future vaccine candidates might need to target both the infection and the very early pathogenic signal in response to HIV, in particular at effector sites, including mucosa. The future vaccine candidate might not protect against infection, but should at least be able to protect against HIV pathogenicity and thus against AIDS. We may need to combine vaccination to novel therapy, or why not, to gene silencing in the future. I would like to conclude by saying that vaccine research is an area where we may expect the most relevant progress in HIV/AIDS research to occur in this millennium. But there is still a long way to go before knowing if one day we will be able or not to deliver a vaccine. We should keep in mind that there is always hope in science, and always remember that the best long-term hope to control HIV/AIDS is to consider all progress in science in both prevention and treatment as an integrated approach to care. It's why it's so critical to urgently fill the gaps in science for vaccine discovery, as it is for filling the gaps of the fund.
Merci, Professor Barry Sunusi, for your insightful presentation this morning and for providing us hope and realism around the HIV vaccine. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome you to Canada and to Toronto. We are proud to be hosting this conference and to bring you the top in science, as we are hearing today, around the issues of prevention, and also the top in community efforts to fight the disease. Countries that have been successful in curbing the HIV epidemic among injection drug users have been those who have had men and women who've had the courage to deal with the issues, to set up needle exchanges, supervised injecting sites, even when it was not legally sanctioned. Dr. Alex Wodak is such a visionary and dedicated physician. Dr. Wodak, who I have the honor of introducing this morning, is the director of the Alcohol Drug Service at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, Australia, a position that he's held since 1982. Where his major responsibilities include the care of individuals with drug and alcohol dependence, but also doing teaching and research, and he has published extensively, has more than 200 scientific papers, and has been a leader in this area of research. He is known for helping to establish Australia's first needle and syringe program and medically supervised injection centers before they were, as I mentioned, legal or pre-legal. Dr. Wodak was president of the International Harm Reduction Association and is currently president of the Australian Drug Law Reform Foundation. He has worked on HIV control among injection drug users in developing countries in Asia, South America, the Middle East, and worked in collaboration with the World Health Organization, UNAIDS. Dr. Wodak has also been extensively involved in research in the prison system, an interest he and I share in common. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Wodak.
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to respond to the following questions. First, how important globally is HIV among injecting drug users? Second, what can be done to control HIV among injecting drug users? Third, what is harm reduction? Fourth, what is its current status? Fifth, are we doing what has to be done? Sixth, what stops us doing what has to be done? Seven, what are the next steps? And finally, some concluding remarks. What is the global importance of HIV among injecting drug users? 30% of global HIV infections now occur outside sub-Saharan Africa, and that proportion is growing. 30% of these infections outside sub-Saharan Africa now involve injecting drug users. And that proportion, too, is growing. This means that injecting drug users now account for about 1 in every 10 new global HIV infections, and that proportion is also growing. Also, in at least half a dozen countries, generalized HIV epidemics started among injecting drug users, often with prison inmates sharing injecting equipment. So injecting drug users are a very important group when it comes to controlling HIV in the whole community. Injecting drug use has now been reported in 144 countries worldwide, and in 128 of these 144 countries, HIV has been reported among injecting drug users. More than 41 countries have reported that HIV prevalence among injecting drug users is now greater than 5%. Global illicit drug turnover was estimated by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime to be $322 billion a year, while a recent report to the Blair Cabinet in the United Kingdom estimated profit to account for 26 to 58% of the turnover of the illicit drug industry. Injecting drug use is still spreading. It has now been reported from at least 10 countries in Africa. How can countries control HIV among injecting drug users? First, injecting drug users need education about HIV. This must be simple, explicit, fear-based, and factual. Next, needle and syringe programs are needed so that sterile injecting equipment is readily available and greatly utilized, and also to ensure that used injecting equipment becomes less readily available. The time taken for injecting equipment to circulate in the community needs to be minimized. We need a choice of effective, attractive and accessible drug treatments, especially substitution treatment such as methadone and buprenorphine for heroin injectors. Finally, community development of injecting drug users is needed so that drug users become part of the solution, helping to implement HIV prevention strategies. This package is often referred to as harm reduction. Another benefit of substitution treatment for injecting drug users is that it improves their adherence to antiretroviral treatment. Harm reduction is one of the most effective interventions in the entire HIV/AIDS repertoire. It is needed in both community and closed settings, that is, in places like detention centres and prisons. The scientific debate, ladies and gentlemen, is now over. Harm reduction has now been shown to be effective in substantially reducing new HIV infections, free of any serious side effects, especially increasing drug use, and also it is cost-effective. This evidence is now abundant, consistent, and compelling. Harm reduction has averted HIV epidemics among injecting drug users in some countries and brought existing epidemics under control in other countries. The earlier and more vigorously harm reduction is implemented, the better the results. Harm reduction means that reducing the health, social, and economic problems resulting from drugs is even more important than reducing drug consumption. It means that it is more effective to set and achieve realistic but suboptimal objectives than to set but fail to reach utopian goals. It means that 80% of something is better than 100% of nothing. What is the current status of harm reduction? Harm reduction is now accepted by most major United Nations agencies, including the World Health Organization, UNAIDS, and an increasing majority in the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, UNICEF and the World Bank, and the International Federation of Red Cross, Red Crescent Societies, and many countries in Europe, Asia, Oceania, and countries like Canada and Brazil. The number of organizations and countries which accept harm reduction is growing steadily. Harm reduction, though, is still opposed by the International Narcotics Control Board and the United States of America and a few other countries. But the number of countries and organizations which reject harm reduction is shrinking every year. At the critical meeting of the Program Coordinating Board of UNAIDS in June 2005, convened to finalize the organization's HIV prevention policy, 21 countries wanted to include references to harm reduction, needle syringe programs, and substitution treatment. Only one country, the United States of America, rejected including these references. Fortunately, public health and common sense prevailed. All 25 members of the European Union now have needle and syringe programs and methadone treatment. The 25 countries of Eastern and Central Europe and Central Asia now all have needle and syringe programs. In Asia, where half the world's population lives, harm reduction is now accepted in most populous countries, including China, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Burma, Taiwan, India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. Every year, some new countries accept harm reduction, but no country which has started harm reduction has ever regretted that decision and then reversed this commitment. This map shows the global uptake of substitution treatment of heroin users, with 48 countries in red providing methadone treatment, 34 countries in blue providing buprenorphine treatment, and some other countries in green providing both. This map shows 65 countries in green providing at least some needle syringe programs, with 10 countries in red with no needle syringe programs. 5 years ago, these two maps would have shown a very different picture. If we accept that injecting drug use is an important part of the HIV pandemic and that we have known for at least 15 years how to control it, are we doing what has to be done? There has been a huge increase in the acceptance of harm reduction globally in the last 5 years. Implementation of harm reduction programs is now starting in many countries, but coverage is still very, very low, especially where it is most needed, that is, in Central and Eastern Europe and Central, South, Southeast and East Asia. And coverage in prisons worldwide is even worse. What are the important barriers to implementation? Excessive reliance on drug law enforcement is the major barrier to harm reduction. Sam Friedman and his colleagues have recently demonstrated this in a study carried out in 89 large cities in the United States of America, where they estimated the number of injecting drug users per capita and HIV seroprevalence among these injecting drug users. They then compared these data to three legal measures: drug arrests per capita, police employees per capita, and corrections expenditure per capita. They found that no legal measure, neither drug arrests, nor police employees, nor corrections expenditure, correlated with the number of injecting drug users per capita. But the greater these three legal measures were in a particular city, the higher the HIV prevalence among injecting drug users. The authors concluded that legal measures had little deterrent effect on the number of injecting drug users in the city, but increasing the number of drug arrests or police employees or corrections expenditure may increase the spread of HIV among injecting drug users. Therefore, Friedman and his colleagues suggested that there is a need to consider alternative methods of maintaining social order. There have been similar warnings in the past. In 1976, 5 years before the first announcement of AIDS, Dr. Joe Westermeyer studied the introduction of a prohibition of opium smoking in three Asian countries. He found that within 10 years of prohibiting opium smoking among elderly men, opium disappeared, but was replaced by heroin injecting among young and sexually active men. Westermeyer called this the pro-heroin effects of anti-opium policies. When we think now about the war against drugs, we have to ask ourselves whether the anti-heroin policies of today are, inadvertently, pro-HIV in their effects. We have many other barriers to harm reduction, including the immense stigma of drug use, which is made even worse when drug law enforcement is intensified. Authorities in many countries in the era of HIV are still fighting the last war, the war against drugs. But as Donald Rumsfeld, US Secretary of Defense, said in 2001, if demand persists, it's going to find ways to get what it wants. And if it isn't from Colombia, it's going to be from someplace else. The United States of America is still leading the global opposition to harm reduction. But the US has an annual AIDS incidence of 14.7 per 100,000, the highest in the industrialized world, and almost five times higher than the country with the next highest AIDS incidence in the industrialized world. And at least 25% of AIDS cases in the United States are attributed to injecting drug use. So this is the result, the public health outcome, of a national policy of vigorously opposing harm reduction. We still fight too many wasteful battles. The International Narcotics Control Board has been trying since 1995 to shift buprenorphine to the more restrictive 1961 International Drug Treaty, and it still tries relentlessly to undermine harm reduction. France, in 2006, is trying to reclassify buprenorphine as a narcotic, even though buprenorphine, together with needle syringe programs, brought HIV under control among injecting drug users in France. Western Europe, Japan, and the United States spend $350 billion US a year on agricultural protection. But what options do drug producer nations have? If Afghanistan cannot sell onions and potatoes to Europe at a reasonable price, it will sell heroin. If Caribbean countries cannot sell bananas to the United States of America at a reasonable price, they will sell cocaine. Fairer international trade policies are part of the picture we have to think about to control HIV. Why do some people still oppose harm reduction? This debate is a conflict between two philosophies. On the one hand, consequentialists evaluate interventions by considering the net effect of benefits and costs. On the other hand, non-consequentialists evaluate interventions by what they consider to be their moral worthiness. They care more about whether their policies are, quotes, sending the right message, end quotes, than the consequences of their actions. But what is the morality of ignoring clear scientific evidence and consequently condemning future generations in that country to endemic HIV? What are the next steps? First, we have to recognize that drugs are primarily a health and social problem. We will always need some drug law enforcement, but as a secondary support, not as the primary response to drugs. This means that funding for health measures needs to be raised to the same level enjoyed by drug law enforcement. We need more inclusive planning. All major stakeholders must be involved, including law enforcement and including injecting drug users. Expanding coverage of harm reduction strategies to the scale needed to control this epidemic is now the major priority in most countries. This means basing policy firmly on science and human rights. Unless policy is based firmly on both science and respect for the human rights of drug users, we will never achieve control of HIV in this critical population, and that means the general community will consequently be condemned for generations to have high prevalence of HIV. In some countries, the debate about harm reduction has not yet been won and needs to be won quickly. We need to prevent HIV among injecting drug users in the Middle East and North Africa, where this part of the epidemic is still at a relatively early stage and where much misery could still be prevented in an already highly troubled region. And we need to start developing effective substitution treatments for people who inject cocaine or amphetamine, similar to the methadone treatment we have today for heroin injectors. In summary, first, HIV among injecting drug users is a very important part of the global epidemic. Harm reduction is an effective, safe, and cost-effective way of quickly bringing this important part of the epidemic under control. Third, the scientific debate about harm reduction is now over. Fourth, acceptance of harm reduction today is overwhelming and growing. Harm reduction is now the international mainstream, while the war against drugs approach is now only supported by a small and shrinking minority. Five, though improving, coverage of harm reduction programs in many parts of the world is still extremely low. Expansion of these programs to scale is now the major issue of harm reduction. Harm reduction coverage is even worse in jails and prisons. Excessive reliance on drug law enforcement is the major barrier to implementing programs to scale. Consequently, a more balanced approach from drug law enforcement is needed urgently. Nine, we have to recognize that drugs are primarily a health problem. 10, the choice is either controlling HIV infection among injecting drug users or sending what some consider to be the right message. We can't have both. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, let us think for a minute and ask ourselves, who is the real risk taker? Is it the injecting drug user, often poor, often uneducated, often unemployed, often living in a developing country? There is no doubt that these injecting drug users take risks, but I suggest they take risks nothing on the scale of the real risk taker, policymakers, usually well-educated, powerful, working from a fancy office, but often acting in defiance of a vast body of evidence, even worse, obscenely and indulgently in denial. 8 years ago, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime convened a major drugs conference at the United Nations in New York entitled, quote, "A Drug-Free World, We Can Do It." And just 3 years ago, the same organization claimed that we were making, quote, "encouraging progress towards still distant goals," meaning the goal of a drug-free world. If we are to achieve control of HIV among injecting drug users, we need policies based on the world we live in, not based on fantasy. And just as we need consistency from donors, so too it is time for the UN system to develop one position on drugs, harm reduction, and a declaration of unity document, which will be signed by all major harm reduction organizations, calls for just that, and is being released at the end of this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Wodak. In closing, I would like to thank all the speakers for so eloquently providing us with an overview of the proven approaches and new technologies that are available to us. And indeed, we have come a long, long way from the early days when we had very little available to us. But it is clear that we need to utilize a multi-sectorial and multi-pronged approach if we are to continue our fight against HIV and AIDS. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.